Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. His name is Jerome. He calls himself Jay. Me? I call him Mr. Chairman. Fed Chairman Jay Powell. Straight ahead today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C. today, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, the 12th of July. Glad, as always, to have you along, everybody. You know how it takes you a while to settle into a new space, to get all your stuff on the shelves and get everything just the way you want? Turns out the same thing happens even, or maybe especially, when you get a really big job. Jay Powell has been the chairman of the Federal Reserve for about 5.5 months now, and he's still got empty bookshelves in his office, save one of those Wisconsin cheesehead things. He's a Packers fan, apparently. There's also a guitar on the floor, hard copy newspapers as well, and a whole lot of economic policy going on. So here you go. Jay Powell in his office at the Federal Reserve Building on Constitution Avenue this morning.
So this is a weird way to start this interview, but the thing is that Fed chairmen don't do a whole lot of interviews. And this is, I think, your first broadcast interview, right? Since you got
this
job?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. Why are you doing this interview?
You know, part of it just is that I feel that we have an obligation to explain ourselves. I think we're shifting our focus a little bit to address sort of the American people more generally and try to explain what we do, why we're doing it, and how we carry out the important jobs that Congress has given us.
I don't know if you heard. I don't know if you heard Marketplace the last time you had a press conference back in at the end of the beginning of June. I made a little fun of you, and I guess of myself too, because you started that press conference by saying, in essence, I'm going to try to explain what the Fed does. And I said, hey, whoa, that's my job. You're being extremely intentional about this.
Yes, very much so. I think, first of all, it's been a long march to transparency on the part of the Fed. If you go back 25 years, we were very inscrutable. We didn't explain ourselves to the markets or to the public. And there's been a revolution, really. And I'm really just continuing the work that began really under Chairman Greenspan, right, Chairman Bernanke, and Chair Yellen. And I'm just carrying that forward. Congress has given us these jobs, really important jobs, which are, you know, maximum employment, stable prices, yep, regulate the banks, protect the consumers, and look after financial stability. And I want to explain that in a way that is comprehensible very broadly, particularly to the public, but also to Congress, which has this important oversight role. And I think it's important in a democracy. That transparency enables accountability, which is what gives us democratic legitimacy.
So to that point about financial stability and ensuring American consumers are protected, this is, as I'm sure you're aware, the 10th anniversary of the financial crisis. And I want to go back. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on the past because there's a whole lot of things in the future that I want to talk to you about coming in the future. But I do want to go back to your confirmation hearings for a minute and run this quote by you from part of your testimony during those hearings. You said, above all, even as we draw on the lessons of the past, we must be prepared to respond decisively and with appropriate force to new and unexpected threats to our nation's financial stability and economic prosperity. What, other than the need for appropriate force, what did you learn from the financial crisis? What lessons did you take that you now bring to this job?
If you look back to the financial crisis, what happened was we had a housing bubble, and then we had widespread defaults and things like that. And that shock, if you will, hit the financial system. And the financial system should have been able to handle that and wasn't. So what the big storm showed was a whole bunch of weaknesses in the way we supervise banks, in the financial markets broadly. So we spent a decade going back and fixing all of those weaknesses, which essentially require the government and the taxpayer to step in behind the financial system and the banks in particular. And I think we nationally, everyone looked around and said, let's not do that again anytime soon. And I think it's really important that we protect and extend the main pillars of what we did: higher capital, higher liquidity, better risk management, stress testing. And, you know, we're not going to forget those lessons, but we're going to try to make sure that the things that we've done have been right and efficient too.
I want to get to the regulatory part of your job, which you address right there in a second. But I want to first talk about some of the things that came out of the financial crisis that we're still dealing with. And maybe the most relevant for consumers in this economy is the idea that wages now for a decade or more really have been stuck. And the question is, as you consider your dual mandates of price stability and maximum employment, where are wages on your list of things to worry about? And what really power do you have?
So wages were low, and that was understandable after the financial crisis because unemployment was extremely high. Unemployment was 10% in 2009. As unemployment has declined now all the way down to 4%, the lowest it's been in 20 years, we would have expected wages to move up fairly significantly. Mm-hmm. I think part of that is that wages should reflect inflation plus productivity. So if you're delivering more output per hour,
right,
it should be reflected. Productivity has been very, very low. But there is still a bit of a puzzle in that we're hearing about labor shortages now all over the country in many, many different occupations in different geographies. And one would have expected, I would have expected, that wages would move up a little bit more. So I think we don't directly look so much at wages as we do price inflation, but I think we're looking very carefully at maximum employment, and that is one of the things that pushes up wages and price inflation.
Right. But why are they stuck? Is it just that we're not producing enough widgets per hour? Is it robots? I mean, what is going on? Because that's the thing that people want to know about.
So one big part of the explanation is certainly that inflation has been low and productivity has been low. So productivity just means how much your output per mm-hmm. hour increases. And that's what you should expect as a worker to get paid for, is enough to cover inflation plus how much did your output go.
Right.
So if you take that at the aggregate national level, if you add those two up, that's actually pretty consistent with what's been happening with wages. Again, I wouldn't call it a mystery, but I would say that it's a bit of a puzzle given how tight labor markets appear to be. And what we are hearing from employers really is that they can't find workers, and you're wondering, well, why aren't wages going up faster?
Why aren't they paying them, right?
It's a good question. Yeah, it's a good question. We don't really have the answer to that question.
Which is a little troubling if you're the guy running the economy.
I don't think of myself as the guy running the economy. You know, the economy is a $20 trillion economy.
Economy runs itself. You keep close to
that. A lot of decision makers out there on it.
Right.
You know, it's not a mystery, really. The place where there's a bit of a puzzle, as I mentioned, is that you would have expected as markets got tighter, you expect the price to go up. And I think we're starting to see that, too. I do think we're starting to see that.
Let me ask you then about inflation and about prices, which are, as you say, starting to tick up to where the Federal Reserve wants it to be. I'll note here that we're talking at 8:24 in the morning on the day that consumer prices come out, and they come out in 6 minutes, with the caveat that this is going to air now in 5-6 hours from now, whatever it is. You have the number in your back pocket. You know what the number is. Inflation, CPI?
Well, let's just say that I do get a look in advance at these things, yes.
You're not going to tell me what it is, even though
we're not
going to air this until...
Definitely not.
Score one for the chairman's adherence to the rules.
Not going to say anything that would suggest it might be.
Absolutely fair enough. So asking this question blind then, if we can't figure out what's going on with wages, and if inflation is only ticking up slowly, how satisfied are you that the Federal Reserve is doing it right when they adjust interest rates and when they are looking at these things in the macro economy?
I think the economy is in a really good place. As I mentioned, unemployment is now 4%, and another bright, which is the lowest it's been in 20 years. The other thing that's good that's been happening is for 5 years, we've seen people coming back into the labor force or not leaving it, which is a healthy thing. So this strengthening, tightening labor market that, you know, we've been supporting with low interest rates has really been working for American workers and families. Inflation has been below our 2%. We target 2% PCE inflation, which is a little bit lower than the CPI number that will be published later this morning. So I think we're in a good place.
All right. So that was part one with Jay Powell. More coming up in just a bit. But we are going to circle back to that exchange he and I had about this morning's inflation number, the one he wouldn't tell me about 6 minutes early, which was, of course, and to be clear, the right thing to do. But anyway, once I get out of his office, I turn on my phone to learn that prices at the consumer level, the CPI as it's called, are rising at their fastest annual pace since early 2012, almost 3% year on year, well above that 2% mark that Chairman Powell and his colleagues in the Fed are so fond of. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look at the whys and the wherefores of inflation in this economy, both the CPI and the Fed's preferred measure, PCE. It's called Personal Consumption Expenditure, which you heard the chairman talk about. Here's Nancy.
For starters, inflation can be a good thing. It's a sign of a growing economy. People have more money in their pockets.
People then spend that money on goods. That then drives up demand and drives up the price of those goods.
That was economist Alan Detmeister of UBS. He says prices are up for food, cars, gas. They're in the basket of goods tracked by the CPI. But the Fed uses a different yardstick to measure inflation. That core PCE rate, prices on the goods it tracks, are less volatile. The core PCE just hit 2%. So says Lindsay Piegza, chief economist at Stifel Fixed Income, the Fed.
They can be patient. There is no concern, at least at this point, that the inflation dragon is lurking around the corner.
But there could be new tariffs on $200 billion worth of products from China around the corner, including consumer goods like dog food and beauty products. If the Trump administration makes good on its threats, economist Gus Fauché of PNC Financial Services Group says the proposed tariffs could cause a one-time jump in prices. Not a big deal, but
if we do see more tit-for-tat retaliation, then that could lead to a stronger inflation over the longer run, and that would be something the Fed is concerned about.
And something that could cause the Fed to rethink its plan for gradual, gentle interest rate increases. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Also, given our conversation with Jay Powell today, we've got an explainer of what the Fed actually, you know, does. All you've got to do is say to your Alexa, "Alexa, make me smart." And take a listen. It'll play for you. On Wall Street this Thursday, look, traders are going to trade inflation and trade wars. Whatevs. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, we're going to pick up with Fed Chairman Jay Powell again, pretty much right where Nancy Marshall-Genzer left us off in her inflation story, the risks to this economy faces with trade policy going the way it's going.
As this economy gets more normal and as your function in it gets more normal with interest rates and inflation, there are some unusual and arguably not normal things happening. And I'm speaking now specifically about trade policy in the United States and how things are going. You said at your last press conference, that members of the Federal Open Market Committee had remarked on uncertainty and risk being a factor in businesses that they're talking to. I wonder how worried you are. Granted, the Fed does not have trade policy as one of its mandates, but how much does trade policy weigh on you?
So that's right. I would say Congress and the administration really have that responsibility. But you're right. And through the 12 Reserve Banks and our own personal contacts, we have really deep contacts all around the country, right, and with business leaders, and by the way, also other leaders and nonprofits at universities and that kind of thing. And we are hearing a rising level of concern about the effects of changes in trade policy. We put that in the things that we publish. It comes up in the FOMC and we put it in the minutes. I think if you're picking up a newspaper today, you're hearing that from a lot of businesses. The truth is this: since World War II, we've had this trading system develop, and consistently tariffs have come down and trade has grown. And I think that's served the global economy and particularly the United States economy very well. But it doesn't help everyone. There are always particular populations and geographies that are negatively affected by trade. And the country no country has really done a good job of addressing those concerns. We need to do that. I think this process that is going on now is a new one. It's very difficult to predict how it turns out, and we'll just have to see.
Which, I mean, I'm going to poke you in the eye a little bit, because that kind of sounds like a punt, right? We're just going to have to see. The fact is that trade policy today is changing the way people are behaving, businesses are behaving. If you call farmers, hog farmers and soybean farmers and apple farmers like I do, they are deeply worried. And the question is, even though you don't have it as a formal responsibility, what are your tools if a trade war slows this economy?
So again, the administration says that what it's trying to achieve is lower tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it works out that way, then that'll be a good thing for our economy. If it works out other ways, so that we wind up having high tariffs on a lot of products and a lot of traded goods and services, let's say, and that they become sustained for a long period of time, then yes, that could be a negative for our economy. You ask what our tools are.
Yeah.
We essentially have our interest rate tools. So if the economy weakens, we can lower interest rates. We can slow the pace at which we're increasing them. I wouldn't want to dive into a bunch of hypotheticals mm-hmm. here, but I would say you can imagine situations which would be very challenging where inflation is going up and the economy is weakening.
And you're lowering rates all the same, just waiting for stuff to get better.
Yeah, again, it's not at all clear how it would evolve. You know, inflation could move up just sort of a step up in the price level, which wouldn't affect future inflation, and that would be something you tend to look through what we call a supply shock.
Yep.
But again, I don't want to get into a lot of hypotheticals. I just think at this point, we're watching carefully and, hoping for a good result.
Are you watching with concern?
You know, when you can ask me the same question about a lot of different areas. So when we don't make the policy, we don't praise it, we don't criticize it, we take it as a given. And in this particular case, it's not our policy. Part of the independence that we have is to stick to our lane, stick to our knitting. So really wouldn't want to comment on fiscal policy, really, or trade policy.
Of course, I'm going to have to ask you now about fiscal policy. because as you know, Congress passed a tax law, which greatly increases our debt and deficits. There's talk now of a second tax bill. Acknowledging that fiscal policy is not a thing you can do anything about, debt does affect this economy. It does affect the way consumers behave. Asking again, I guess, the concern question, where is that on your list of things to worry about?
Let me take that with a short-term sense and then a long-term
sure.
sense. So in the near term, the fiscal changes that were made at the end of last year and earlier this year, the tax reform, the tax cuts, and the spending increases are very likely, in our view and in my view, to support economic activity here in the United States for at least the next few years. Longer term, it is widely understood that the United States is on an unsustainable fiscal path, largely due to the interaction between an aging population and a healthcare system that delivers pretty average, healthcare at a cost that is much higher than that of any other advanced economy.
When you go talk to members of Congress about this, do they get it? Do they understand that part of fiscal policy?
I think there are a range of perspectives on that, but my general takeaway would be that elected officials generally do understand the issues. They may have a range of opinions, but they generally do understand them. Just it's not easy to get things done, particularly in a political context. We have our tools; we can use them. We have a statute that gives us the independence to use them without political considerations. But it's not easy to get things done in elected bodies anywhere in the world.
Coming up,
let's control the controllable. So what we control is what we do.
How and why the Fed tries to stay in its lane. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so here you go. Dow Industrial's up 224 today, 0.9%, 24,924. The NASDAQ up 107, 1.3%, 78.23. The S&P 500 gained 24 points, about 0.8%. 27.98. Defense companies boomed today on the back of President Trump's call for NATO members to spend more on defense. Northrop Grumman up 3.3%. Not just more on defense, but more on American defense is what he said. Raytheon beamed up 1.7% today. Lockheed Martin bounced up about 0.2%. Papa John's fired up 11%. Founder John Schnatter resigned as chairman after admitting he used a racial slur during a company conference call in May. And other pizza news, Papa Murphy. Yes, there's a Papa Murphy pizza. Climbed 0.6%. You're listening to Marketplace. Mark in Wynwood, Pennsylvania, wrote to tell us how much he appreciates the way Marketplace presents in-depth news and tells offbeat economic stories he doesn't find anyplace else. If you agree with Mark, please join him as a Marketplace investor by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to everybody who contributes to keep public service journalism strong. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're going to go back to the Jay Powell well one last time today for some of the less policy-specific but still really tangible parts of, first of all, him getting the job, but also him doing the job in 2018. Here you go.
When you got this job, much was made of the fact that you're not an academic economist. You come from the law, from banking, from private equity. How does that affect how you do your job?
Well, I'd start by saying that I did join, as I mentioned, I've been here for more than six years now, so I've had an awful lot of time to learn the economics and find it really interesting, and I've worked hard at that. So,
and there are a lot of economists here, so you know, you've got the academic support, right? But as you go about your day-to-day, how does that influence how you think about this? I mean, I'm sure you saw the Reuters story about your calendar, how you meet more with bankers and lawmakers than other chairs have, who meet more with economists. How does who Jay Powell is affect how he does this job is the question.
You know, it's a hard question for me to answer about myself, but
maybe I should ask.
I do. You know, I would say, as far as meeting with Congress is concerned, I'm going to wear the carpets of Capitol Hill out by walking those halls and meeting with members. I feel like that's a really important thing that the chair can do, which is part of what I want to accomplish with clarity and explanation and transparency. I want to push really hard on that, and I want them to think that we're responsive to their concerns and their thoughts, and that we're here to be as clear as we possibly can.
There's a question that has to be asked here, actually a couple of them, about the political environment in which this economy operates right now. Granting that the Fed has always been a source of political frustration for many in the executive branch, it's worth pointing out here that Larry Kudlow, the chairman of the president's National Economic Council, and the president himself have said they are low interest rate guys. Larry Kudlow encourages the Fed to move very slowly on interest rates on the theory that rising interest rates would be a tricky thing for the president politically. Do you think it's appropriate for the White House to be not telling the Fed what to do, but saying these things in public?
Let me just say, I'm not concerned about it, and I'll tell you why. We have a long tradition here of conducting policy in a particular way, and that way is independent of all political concerns. We do our work in a strictly non-political way based on detailed analysis, which we put on the record transparently, and we don't consider political considerations. We don't take political considerations into account. I would add, though, that no one in the administration has said anything to me that really gives me concern on this front. But this is deep in our DNA for a long, long time. The Fed has felt it important to conduct our business that way. I'm deeply committed to that approach, and so are all of my colleagues here.
Which I understand, but you're also humans. And when the White House leans on you, you must feel it.
Again, nothing has been said to me publicly or privately that gives me any concern about our independence.
Circling back to where we started, just as a way to wrap this up, you are taking great pains to make what the Federal Reserve does more transparent, and in a way, the economy more transparent and more understandable to the people living in it. The President of the United States tends to politicize the economy. He says things that are not always entirely accurate about the economy. I wonder how that complicates your job.
Again, I had a great colleague and mentor back in the day who used to bring meetings into focus by saying, let's control the controllable. So what we control is what we do. What we do, and I just told you what we do and what we're always going to do. That's who we are. It's always who we're going to be. We're going to do our business in a way that's strictly non-political without taking political issues into consideration. And that, you know, carries out the mandate Congress has given us. We have the tools to do that. We have a statute that allows us to do that in a way that is independent of political considerations. I'm strongly committed to it, and so are my colleagues.
Chairman Powell, thanks for your time, sir.
Thanks very much, Guy.
As always, with these kinds of interviews, there was more to it than we had time for on the air, which I think is at least part of the reason the podcasts were invented. So we put the whole 30 minutes in the Marketplace podcast feed. Should be there today. Check it out. This final note on the way out today, something non-Jay Powell related, huh? Because he's important in all, but enough's enough, right? How about the entertainment industry then? You remember the other day in that story about how AT&T wants its newest acquisition, HBO, to be less on brand and more on making money? Yeah, well, today's Emmy nominations aren't going to help. HBO has been the most nominated network for 17 straight years, but no more. Netflix beat them this year. I personally, by the way, am rooting for The Crown. One more AT&T thing before we go, also related to its acquisition of HBO and the rest of Time Warner. There was that big antitrust trial. AT&T won. The Justice Department lost, and the judge said the deal was completely legal. He imposed no conditions and admonished the government not to appeal. They are appealing. Court filing today said so. All right, we got to go. Time's a little tight. Wall Street today was up, suffice it to say. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Deppe. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back home in Los Angeles tomorrow. Have a great afternoon, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.